The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Okay.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
Yeah.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. And once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
Think.
Just
I love
that.
It. That was great.
It's
thank
Friday. You know, I just, it's Friday. We need to loosen up a little bit because what a week this has been, huh? I mean, talk about a roller coaster from the highs of, you know, being cured of cancer to the lows of watching, you know, disaster unfold. As we end the war in Afghanistan, which is a high. You know, we're all over the place. So welcome to a Friday. We got a busy, busy show for you today. And I want to start off with this. I have been watching a lot of the coverage on television of the end of our occupation of Afghanistan. This is something we have been waiting for, you know, for 20 years, right? But the coverage has all been... It seems like pro-war, like people are angry that we've ended this mess. Now, granted, the end did not come gracefully, but I don't think it ever does. But then again, I'm not the expert on war and peace. So let's bring in our guest, our first guest today. Stephen Miles is the executive director of Win Without War. They're at winwithoutwar.org. Hey, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, good to be here.
You know, we're on an email list together, and I saw what I just mentioned brought up, and I've seen this discussion elsewhere as well, and I'm glad to know I'm not the only one who's noticed it. I'm seeing all over the television, it doesn't matter what channel, and I don't watch Fox, people like Bolton, John Bolton, Karl Rove, Condoleezza Rice, you know, Bush officials. I'm not seeing any advocates for peace, like any representatives from Win Without War or other such organizations that are pro-peace. It seems to be sort of a pro-war stance, like they didn't think we should end this occupation. There's a real disconnect here, isn't there?
Yeah, look, I think there is. I think you're absolutely right to talk about what we've seen from the media is the same kind of failures that we've seen over the course of the entire war. A failure to put on voices that represent the American public. Also, importantly, a failure to listen to Afghan voices.
Right.
You know, it's not hard for them in this moment, if they want to talk about the future of Afghan women and girls, to find Afghan women and girls and ask them, as opposed to putting on John Bolton to talk about Afghan women and girls. We should have learned this lesson a really long time ago. Unfortunately, it seems like we haven't. I think to give some credit where it's due, there are a couple of folks who are getting this right.
Tell me.
Mehdi Hasan. His show, both on Peacock, and he's been hosting All In with Chris Hayes, has been phenomenal throughout this coverage. But by and large, we're seeing what we've seen during the course of this 20-year occupation and the last 20 years of war, which is a failure of the media to tell the story, to bring the American public's viewpoints into the conversation, and to not continue to give airtime to the very folks who oversaw failure after failure after failure to somehow explain how it's not all their fault.
Right. And they're holding them up as like they're the authorities here. They would have done it right, as opposed to, you know, the Biden administration who screwed it all up, without mentioning the fact that really this was the Trump administration who put together this strategy. Now, I'm not saying that Biden and his administration are free and clear. They deserve some blame for not thinking this out better. But seriously, according to Donald Trump, we were going to be out in May, right? This was going to be over in May, according to the deal he cut with the Taliban. And then Joe Biden said, well, it'll be by September 11th. So figure by the end of August. If everybody knew we were pulling out, why did they wait till we were already gone to try to get out?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And let me start, I think, where we should acknowledge that there is a humanitarian crisis right
now. Yes, there is.
There's challenges. Uh-huh. We're seeing very, very difficult images, obviously, over the last several days. And the president's priority right now should be saving as many Afghan lives as he can, getting as many folks who need safely evacuation out of the country evacuated, and opening our doors here to as many Afghans as necessary who need a safe refuge after our 20 years of occupation. But you're right, that story about what's happening right now is not simply a story about mistakes that the Biden administration may or may not have made. And there will be a time for a full report and full investigations about decisions that we should have made differently. But we absolutely can't have that conversation in a vacuum. We can't talk about this without talking about the history of what's happened here. You know, it's worth remembering because we hear a lot of talk about precipitous withdrawal. Barack Obama in 2011 announced the beginning of the drawdown of troops from Afghanistan. It was supposed to be done in 2014, mm-hmm. 7 years ago. That timeline slipped and slipped and slipped. But a year and a half ago, Donald Trump signed an agreement in Doha. Mike Pompeo was there with the leader of the Taliban saying, we are going to be out by May of 2021. Now, Mike Pompeo is out there today. He's briefing members of Congress. He's been all over the media trying to say, hey, whoa, look, not our fault. We had a great super secret plan for how this was all going to be done, the same way they had a super secret plan for how the vaccines were going to be rolled out. Look, we have heard and seen the previous administration's actions, and we don't have to speculate how they would have done. They were in charge of this. Donald Trump was the president. Mike Pompeo was the Secretary
right.
of State.
And that leader of the Taliban was in prison. He was locked up for 10 years, right? And Trump correct. Had him released along with like 5,000 other Taliban fighters. So, I mean, I'm sorry, this is on him. And that's the guy that he invited to Camp David to come over to the U.S. and be here ostensibly on 9/11. I mean,
look, as with so much of Donald Trump's presidency, the incompetence is really a major part of this. Look, negotiating directly and having diplomatic engagement is the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. The Taliban controlled during the Trump administration significant swaths of territory in Afghanistan. Any post-U.S. future of Afghanistan was going to include the Taliban in some way. So talking to them was the right thing. Mm-hmm. Now, did they have to leave out the Afghan government?
No.
Did they have to leave out the United Nations? Did they have to leave out civil society? No. And when they did reach an agreement a year and a half ago, did they do anything about how that was going to be implemented? Absolutely not. We know Donald Trump tweeted he wanted the troops out by Christmas.
Right.
That was about a campaign message for him. He never cared about the Afghan people. And if you want to know, you don't have to guess. You don't have to speculate. His administration made it harder for Afghans to get through the very programs that we're talking about now, the SIV, the Special Immigrant Visa Program. They barred the country and tried to end the U.S. refugee resettlement program that would have enabled folks to seek safety so they wouldn't be at the Kabul airport today needing evacuation.
Right.
His administration failed every day. Right. They failed miserably on this, and they don't get to be left out of the reckoning that we should have. But you also alluded to, we can't also just look at the last administration. This is 20 years of occupation.
That's right.
It's actually 4 decades of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan.
Wow.
But we need to at least go back and look at the last 20 years. We need to take a hard look at the Bush administration's decisions and their failures. We need to look at the Obama administration's decisions and failures, including surging troops yeah. in Afghanistan. There is a lot of blame to go around, and that none of that excuses any mistakes that may have been made in the last couple of weeks. But let's be clear, we failed for 20 years
right.
in Afghanistan. When you fail and fail and fail, the question is not why did you fail one more time? It's why did we continue failing for all of those years and never once course correct?
Those are brilliant questions, and they're questions that must be asked. And the media, I couldn't be more disappointed in the lack of, I don't know what the right word is, parody. The fact that they're just going after Biden, I guess they want to show that they can be tough on all sides, but that's nonsense. What they need to do is hold the people accountable, one, who got us into this mess in the first place, and two, who kept it going. Obama, I think, is just as guilty because he kept saying, we're going to draw down, we're going to get out, and he didn't do it. None of them had the balls to get out. So at least I credit Joe Biden with following through and holding to his principles. He said he was against it for a long time. He was against the surge. I think he did the right thing. But then again, there's this disaster going on where, you know, they did it sort of back ass words, although not as bad as Trump put out a statement saying they should have, you know, evacuated Americans first and, yeah. you know, this next and that next and bomb the bases and then bring out the military. Okay, so bomb the military. I mean, the man's a moron. Obviously, they didn't have a plan. But I think the Biden administration didn't think it through either. And then, not too long before we came on the air, Joe Biden did address the nation again. He had an update. He spoke and he answered some questions from the press. But he seems to be not getting the full picture from the people on the ground, or he's lying. And I hate to say that because I want to think he's better than the former guy. But the whole situation, what's going on at the airport, how does he not know? In fact, he said Americans are, you know, if you've got a U.S. passport, the Taliban is letting you through. Well, the Secretary of Defense just a little while ago contradicted what he said and said, no, Americans have been beaten by the Taliban trying to get to the airport. So there's a breakdown in communication there. Joe Biden would do better by just being honest, wouldn't he, at this point?
Well, so I have to confess, I haven't seen the president's remarks. It's been a busy day.
Gotcha.
And so I don't want to comment on his specific remarks. But what I will say is the situation is very fluid on the ground in Afghanistan. Things are changing very rapidly. And there are multiple different stories coming in.
Sure.
About there clearly are folks who are getting to the airport. There clearly are folks who are being impeded and not getting to the airport. This is very typical in a situation like this. You know, it's not dissimilar to a dynamic I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with, Nicole, is right after kind of a major mass shooting or something like that in the United States. And there's lots of conflicting reports.
Sure.
And it takes a while for things to come out. We'll hear over time the reality of what happened and what didn't, where the mistakes were made, where they could have been done different. Hopefully right now, his administration is singularly focused on getting as many people out as they can. Saving lives needs to be their priority, and we hope that it is. We've called on them for that to be the case, as have pretty much everyone around who's not named Stephen Miller has made that call right now. That should be their priority. I'm less concerned right now with what the president says than with what he does, and I hope that his actions over the next couple of days show that he will take every action to save as many lives as possible. Again, though, the history of this didn't start 20 days ago. It started much, much longer ago, 20 years ago. And we need to understand some of the mistakes that have been made throughout. And that just because the media wasn't paying attention to this war before the last couple of weeks, it doesn't mean that it wasn't raging. You know, the last couple of years of this war under Donald Trump were the deadliest years of the war for civilians in Afghanistan.
Really?
Donald Trump dropped more bombs on Afghanistan, the great anti-war president, right? The guy who likes to say he's against war. He dropped more bombs on Afghanistan in a year than anybody else did in a year before him. He surged troops into Afghanistan before he was going to remove them.
Wow.
This isn't simply a story of human suffering right now. This is a story of human suffering right now. And we need to understand that. But if we want to make sure we are never in this place again, if we're never in the position where we're having to evacuate people and rescue them from a situation that we've helped create, we have to learn the lessons of not creating these conditions in the first place, of not starting these endless wars, of understanding that we cannot continue to try to bomb our way to peace around the world, that we need to try different solutions.
Absolutely. 100%. Since you didn't hear Stephen Miles, what the president said, let me just play. I'll play one clip. This was from basically his opening, but it was the one line that stood out to me, and it's what I wanted to hear.
We're going to do everything that we can to provide safe evacuation for our Afghan allies, partners, and Afghans who might be targeted because of their association with the United States. But let me be clear. Any American who wants to come home, we will get you home.
And then he even said that if necessary, they will put out, I don't know the proper words, but basic, I'm paraphrasing, you know, short, small rescue groups to go bring people out. And then one of the reporters, I believe this was somebody from the Associated Press, wanted to clarify. And so asked him again about what he said here.
Would you make the same commitment to bring out Afghans who assisted in the war effort?
Yes. Yes, we're making the same commitment. There's no one more important than bringing American citizens out. I acknowledge that. But they're equally important almost as all those who, those SIVs, we call them, who in fact helped us. They were translators. They went into battle with us. They were part of the operation. As well as we're also trying to get out as many NGOs, non-government organizations, women's organizations, et cetera. We're doing all we can. In the meantime, Secretary Blinken and I am going to be working with our allies to see to it that we can bring international pressure on the Taliban to be, they're looking to gain some legitimacy. They're going to have to figure out how they're going to maintain that country. And there's going to be harsh conditions. We're strong conditions we're going to apply, and it will depend on whether they get help based on whether or not how and well they treat women and girls, how they treat their citizens. So this is just beginning in that score.
Stay past the 31st to make that happen, to bring all the Americans out, to bring those SIVs out.
I think we can get it done by then, but we're going to make that judgment as we go. Now, Justin Sink of Bloomberg. Oh,
so that was just one of the questions. He took a handful of questions, and he did okay. I think, I don't know, has there ever been a war that's ended that we didn't win, that we didn't walk away in victory, that wasn't messy?
Look, I think what the president said, we've seen borne out by repeating in the last couple hours. American forces have begun to leave the airport and rescue some individuals and bring them in. It's starting small. British and French are similarly doing that as well. What's been clear for a while, we need to do more faster.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously the U.S. forces will need to maintain control of the airport. Until this is done, that won't be necessarily August 31st. We'll have to see. As the president alluded, it's changing by the day. I mean, if you think about where we were a couple of days ago, it's hard to say for certainty where we'll be in a couple of days from now. So that is going to continue, and it's important that it does. But you raise a larger point. You wars are destructive in their nature. Wars are damaging to society, to infrastructure, to humans, and most of all to the humans who live through their consequences.
Oh, yeah.
This war has been incredibly deadly, not just for the nearly 2,500 American soldiers who lost their lives and the 20,000 who were injured, but tens of thousands of Afghan, both tens of thousands of Afghan military personnel, as well as tens of thousands of innocent Afghan civilians. This has been a very costly war in two decades that have seen tremendous human costs of American wars throughout the Middle East. You know, we have seen hundreds of thousands of people lose their lives in these wars. You cannot engage in that kind of warfare for decades and expect that you just get to walk away and have everything be fine.
Right.
You know, that's not the way wars work. That's why it's so important that Americans, you know, and Americans understand this. I was just looking at polling before we got on here. You know, Americans obviously overwhelmingly support the withdrawal of U.S. forces. They also overwhelmingly support the taking in of refugees from these wars. They recognize that we have a moral obligation after decades of using these countries as a battlefield to do the right thing and welcome people in who have become refugees because of those conflicts. So they absolutely support that. We have that moral obligation. But the final point I'll make here is, even if we are able to resettle tens of thousands of Afghans, potentially hundreds of thousands like we did after the Vietnam War, that will still leave millions upon millions of people in Afghanistan. And Afghanistan had humanitarian challenges before.
Sure.
There's tens of millions of folks who are suffering from food insecurity right now. There are climate-related challenges, including drought and other issues. The U.S. has a deep moral obligation that isn't just about its refugee resettlement. It is about that. But we are going to need to support Afghanistan with humanitarian aid and support, because we have been a party to causing that destruction over the last 20 years.
Right. But that's going to be made more difficult, isn't it, by the fact that it's the Taliban in charge. Unless they somehow get with civilized society, that might be difficult to accomplish.
It will be difficult. It's worth noting, even during the Taliban's previous rule, before 9/11 in the late 90s, there were international NGOs that were on the ground providing humanitarian services. There are ways to do that. Look, the United States does this right now. There are plenty of regimes in the world that we are not cooperative with.
Sure.
That we view very adversarially. And there are still humanitarian projects in those places and support programs. We're also going to have to internationalize our response. You know, we need to be working in through the United Nations here. We need to be working with partner organizations. The Norwegians, for example, have robust programs. There are other countries that can do some of the work on the ground that the United States may not be able to do, having been an active combatant in this war. We're going to have to be creative. Look, doing the right thing is seldom easy. Doing the wrong thing is often very easy.
Right.
It was very easy for us to bomb Afghanistan.
Sure.
We have massive amounts of capabilities to do that. No doubt it will be harder to do the right thing and to save lives and fulfill our moral obligations, but it remains the necessary thing.
I absolutely agree 100%. Stephen Miles, before I let you go, I mentioned at the top, you're the executive director of Win Without War. The website is winwithoutwar.org. Tell the listeners who might not be familiar with you guys who you are and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. As our name would indicate, our origin story goes back to the days of the Iraq War. We were formed in 2002 in the run-up to the Iraq War in opposition to that war. And we've been active ever since as a network of organizations, of activists who are opposed to the underlying policies that led to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and are generally overly militarized foreign policy. So as you mentioned, our website, winwithoutwar.org, folks can find us on Facebook and Twitter. You know, we really work to support a larger progressive movement engagement on these issues. You know, we need to be progressives, not just at home and on domestic issues, but around the world and in our foreign policy as well. We look to support partner organizations, members of Congress, activists in taking action on these issues. There's ways to do that on our website. And of course, there's ways to support our work as well. But it's mostly just the fundamental thing that I would love to leave your listeners with is there's a pernicious lie in Washington that Americans don't care about foreign policy, mm-hmm. that Americans don't care about these issues, that because there hasn't been marches on Washington opposing this war, that it hasn't been true for a decade that Americans wanted this war to end. Those are lies, but the only way we counteract them is by speaking up, by making our voices heard, by calling our members of Congress, by doing things like listening to this show and other alternative media that gives voice to the, mm-hmm. to the voices that are speaking about these issues. We have to put our values into action. And so whether it's through Win Without War or any other organization, and there are a number of them that do tremendous work in this area, the answer here is to be active.
Be active. And people can get involved at winwithoutwar.org. You can funnel them in the right direction. You guys are involved on a number of different fronts, but you've been consistent. And it's good to have your voice. It's important, especially, as I mentioned, it's so frustrating watching the corporate media, whether it's MSNBC or CNN. It doesn't make a difference. It's been... I don't want to see John Bolton again. I don't want to see another neocon on there telling me how Joe Biden screwed this up. There's a lot of blame to go around, as I've been saying for the last few days. Would it help if maybe our listeners called some of those corporate media outlets and said, how about some pro-peace groups on there too? How about some anti-war groups? How about some other voices other than the people who got us in this mess in the first place?
Well, I think it certainly couldn't hurt, but I think another way that folks can do it is we have this, and it's on our Twitter feed, and I believe it's still pinned to the top, as well as one of the things that's most important is that for too long, it hasn't just been the same voices. It's been the same, frankly, mostly white male voices sitting around Washington talking about what should be done about people around the world. And the impacts are not felt by those of us in Washington, including myself, who are the ones talking about this. And so we've compiled a list of Afghan voices that you can listen to, that you can follow. There's amazing groups out there like Afghans for a Better Tomorrow, who are active right now, who are making their voices heard. And I think one of the things that folks can do is amplify those voices, find them on Twitter, find them in social media, amplify those voices, and do the work that drowns out the corporate media, that drowns out the folks like John Bolton and others. Let's amplify the right voices. Let's amplify the folks who are closest to the harm being done by U.S. foreign policy, because that's the only way we're ever going to get around to changing U.S. foreign policy.
Absolutely. And I need to just single out Barbara Lee one more time. I've sung Absolutely. Her praises a few times this week. She is the only one who 20 years ago voted no on the authorization of use of military force in Afghanistan. The only one in Congress. The first day I said it, people were going, well, Bernie did. No, he didn't. Bernie was in the House then, and he voted for it, as did everyone else. I think there were 10 10 no-shows in the House, and I think 2 in the Senate. But other than Barbara Lee, nobody else voted no. And today she tweeted out, it's time to repeal those AUMFs. And I tweeted back, you are correct then, you're correct now. We need more Barbara Lees. And Stephen Miles, Absolutely. We need more groups like yours. Thank you so much for coming on today, and thank you for the work you're doing. Yours is such an important voice, so I'm glad I could get you on here.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having the conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye. There you go. Stephen Miles, winwithoutwar.org. Do check them out, because they're doing great work. All right. So today we're going to go in. Oh, shoot. In 2 different directions. I just closed out my my meeting, my Zoom, because the next guest is going to come on that same Zoom call. Well, she's got 4 minutes. So I wonder if it'll let me open it again anyway, so that when she comes in, she will have a way to get into the waiting room. Anyway, let me tell you what we're going to segue into next anyway, and that is voting rights. Because, you know, fighting ugly wars, certainly that's, I think, a danger to a democracy. But the other way we lose our democracy and we lose what's, what we stand for is when people aren't allowed to vote. And that's exactly what the Republican Party is doing and what they've been up to, I guess, going back certainly to 1980. You don't need me to play the clip again of Paul Weyrich saying, we don't have good government syndrome. That's where they want everyone to vote. We don't want everyone to vote. When people vote, our influence goes down. What he's saying is the fewer people that vote, the better it is for Republicans. And that's why they've been playing the long game on voter suppression. That's what they're doing. And it's coming to fruition this year. They got a big assist from Donald Trump and the lying, cheating, and stealing that they do. So we know we are at, the highest warning level of, if we don't do something fast, we're going to lose our democracy. So there are 2 bills you know about. We've been talking about them forever. There's the For the People Act, and there's the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. So John Lewis, John Lewis is, he died, but the representative, God, I didn't pull her audio. The congresswoman from Selma, Alabama, stood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge the other day, 2 days ago, I believe, and officially introduced the revised version of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. So, there are a number of groups out there, thankfully, working on this. Now, Congress is on recess now. They're on their, summer break. But because of the whole process around the infrastructure bills, the way it's working, in order to get the second bill, the bigger, the reconciliation package, written, first, they have to pass the budget resolution. They passed it in the Senate last week. Now it's got to move through the House before the legislation can be written. Follow me so far? So the House is coming back into session on Monday, really for 1 day, to vote on the budget reconciliation so that they can go ahead and write this other infrastructure bill and have it ready to go when everybody comes back in September. But they're also going to vote on this John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So in a few minutes, we're going to talk to a woman named Lala Wu. She is the co-founder and executive director of a group called Sister District. And this brings it down to the grassroots level. It's working with, you know, preserving our elections, our right to vote. And so we'll talk with her for a few minutes and see what they're doing to thwart the state legislative threats, to support the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and then to get people out and voting in 2022 and 2024. So important stuff going on there. Before we get to that, though, I just want to let you know that's coming up. We were talking with Stephen Miles a few minutes ago about, obviously, Afghanistan. And one thing that I can't let go of is this guy, Baradi. I think that's his name, Baradi. The head of the Taliban, who Trump had released from prison after 10 years, along with 5,000 other Taliban fighters. And that's who's out there now. That's who's beating people who are trying to get to the airport, right? It's a complicated story. And usually she goes on forever. But Rachel Maddow the other night gave a really good explainer about how this Taliban leader came to be freed.
He was in prison in Pakistan for years. Trump administration asked for him to be released so they could participate in talks with him. They did participate in talks with him. And now today, that same guy, Mullah Baradar, having been sprung from prison at the request of the Trump administration so he could participate in direct talks with Trump administration figures like Mike Pompeo, who signed a deal with him that promised the total withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Now today, that guy is back in Afghanistan for the first time in a decade and apparently ready to lead the new Taliban government in Kabul.
Just incredible, right? Yet they take no responsibility for anything, even though there's tons of audio out there of Trump, you know, bragging about it.
We had a great deal. We worked on it very hard. Mike Pompeo, a brilliant guy, and many others worked on it endlessly. Meetings with the Taliban. Of course, you have to meet with the Taliban. They're the ones that you're negotiating with. I spoke on numerous occasions to the head of the Taliban, and we had a very strong conversation.
To who?
To Mullah Baradar.
There you go.
Who is
Baradar.
Probably the top person. Now, nobody really knows who the top person is, but I would say that's probably the top person. But I had a very strong conversation. I also had a good conversation with him. We talked for a while after that. That was the primary point I was making, and he understood it.
Ugh. Okay. So, you know what? If we're going to point fingers and place blame, have they forgotten who that guy is? All right. So there's that, right? There's that. As we wait for our guest to show up, the other topic, I mean, there's three major issues that should be, you know, messing with your head right about now, because it is mine. There's Afghanistan and what's going on, because I really feel for those people that are stuck there. There's no good answer. There really isn't. War, you know, how does the old poster go? War is not healthy for children and other living things. So there's that. The second is this assault on our voting rights. And all that. By the way, did you see that the Capitol Police are all amping up for there's another protest coming to the Capitol, a protest in honor supporting the 1-6 rioters who are still in jail, who are going to trial. It is opposite world, right? But a strong conversation. Yeah. And then there's COVID, the virus that just won't go away. I'm beyond frustrated by this. So yesterday, I think I told you that, I sort of had an argument with my sister. I have two sisters, neither one of whom I'm very close with. I'm closer with the younger one who lives down here, but I haven't seen her in a couple of years. And she lives 20 minutes away. But anyway, so she's an ESE specialist, in a special ed specialist at an elementary school. So she's around kids. And she was resistant to getting the vaccination, but she got it. She wound up getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But then I'm talking to her the other day. Her daughter, who is 23, she's a year older than Allison, just got her first vaccine a few weeks ago. And I said, why did she wait so long? And she got pissy with me. She's like, I wasn't even convinced. I'm not going to tell her. She has to do it. I tune it out because I just don't want to hear it. Well, it turns out my niece was vaccinated, but guess what? She tested positive. So she's not very sick. She feels like she has the flu. But that's probably because she thankfully got vaccinated, so she didn't get as severe a case as she otherwise would have. We're in Florida. The idiot governor, yet again, oh my God, I got to tell you about the warning that just popped up, the alert that just popped up, has again threatened a number of more school districts down here in Florida are going against his executive order banning mask mandates in schools. Instead, he set up these Regeneron clinics. Now, a dose of Regeneron costs, what, $1,500, $2,000, and you already have to be sick before you get it. It's an antidote. My brain is not working right today. It's a medicine for once you're sick. It's not a vaccine. It's not a preventative. But he's pushing that over vaccinations. And some intrepid reporters found out that his largest donor is a huge investor in the company that makes Regeneron. And when you're talking about Ron DeSantis, that's all you need to know. So today he issued another warning to the people, the Broward County where I live, the Broward County school superintendent, and Alachua County, which is up where Gainesville is, the University of Florida, that if you have 48 hours to turn around on your mask mandate, and if you don't, we're going to start docking your district of funds and your salary. Seriously? This man is just bad news. Bad news all around. And when somebody in the media calls him out on it, he gets angry at them. He's a mini Trump. That's who he is. Well, I bring this up because I want to share with you the best obit I've ever read. Yes, I'm talking about an obituary. I have an obituary here. I don't know what newspaper it's from, but since Mr. Nagy apparently died in Northeast Texas. I don't know. It could be California. It could be St. Louis. It could be Utah. Anyway, let me just read to you this obituary because I'll tell you right now, if I were to die of COVID, I want a similar obituary. And it's here. David M. Nagy, N-A-G-Y. Oh, David W. Nagy, sorry. David W. Nagy passed away on July 22nd, 2020 in the ICU at Christus Good Shepherd Hospital in Longview. He suffered greatly from the ravages of the COVID-19 virus and the separation from his much-loved family, who were not allowed at his bedside. Mr. Nagy was born November 7th, 1940, in Salt Lake City, Utah. He spent most of his life in California. He made his home in Northeast Texas many years ago after retiring, living in Jefferson for the past 3 years. So there you go. He lived in Texas. Mr. Nagy lives behind his inconsolable wife, Stacy, his 5 children, Heath, Stephanie, Heather, David, and Vicky, as well as numerous grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and friends. Family members believe David's death was needless. They blame his death and the deaths of all other innocent people on Trump, Abbott, and all the other politicians who did not take this pandemic seriously and were more concerned with their popularity and votes than lives. Also to blame are the many ignorant, self-centered, and selfish people who refuse to follow the advice of the medical professionals, believing their right not to wear a mask was more important than killing innocent people. A statement issued by the family declared that Dave did everything he was supposed to do, but you did not. Shame on all of you, and may karma find you all. Yes. Oh my God, yes. This is an honest obituary. This is what needs to be said. This is what we all need to do. But that's not what you're hearing. I will post this on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com/8-20-21. That's where the show will be posted. I'll put this up there so you can share it and give it to your family. Hopefully, you're not going to get COVID because you're smart enough to wear a mask when you go out and get vaccinated. It's these science deniers that I just don't know what to do with it. And yes, otherwise reasonable people. Now, my sister's not stupid. And yes, she got vaccinated, and thankfully her kid did too. But really? I mean, what? It took this long, and now, you know, Lindsay is infected? There's no reason for it. That's why I told my sister, I don't see her, and I'm not going to see her until this is all over, because she goes out. She goes out to bars, you know, to see bands. She doesn't take the proper precautions. I think she is playing with fire, and now is not the time to play with fire. All right. I see our guest is here. So we're going to segue into the other major issue that you all should be paying attention to. And that is, they are trying to steal your right to vote. The Trump administration was great at this. You know, one thing they were really good at was gaslighting America. They would tell you the sky is green and the grass is blue. That's why I don't often have Republicans on the show, because if they won't stipulate to basic facts, I can't have a discussion with them. And now what they're trying to do is put everything in place so that on the off chance Donald Trump should get back in office, he could pull off what he tried to do in the aftermath of the 2020 election, which is have the state officials flip the people's vote in each state. Starting with Georgia, Arizona, Florida. I mean, places where there are Republican governors, they are putting through these horrible voter suppression laws. They're working their way through the state legislatures, and it will enable them to take control of the voting apparatus in a state if they don't like the outcome of it. So with that, let me bring in our guest. Lala Wu is the co-founder and executive director of Sister District Project. The Sister District Project, is that the name of the group?
That's correct. Sister District. Hello, Nicole.
Hi, it's so nice to meet you, and thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit about Sister District before we get to specifics.
Sister District builds progressive power in state legislatures, and we do so because state legislatures have an incredible impact on our everyday lives when it comes to the policies that matter most to us, whether that's voting rights, which is the topic of today's call, or the environment, education, labor, you name it. It's really where the policy rubber hits the road. And it's also, of course, in most states, the state legislature controls redistricting. You know, as the census data just came out, officially kicking off the redistricting process, we are going to see lots of fights and lots of activity around redistricting in all 50 states in the country. In many of those states, the process is controlled by state legislatures. Mm-hmm. And as a result, state legislatures are just incredibly, incredibly important. And for all of you activists out there, it's also the biggest bang for your buck, because these races also tend to be quite cheap. You know, they're very affordable. Instead of millions of dollars that it takes to run a congressional, senatorial, or let alone presidential race, these state legislative races, they might just be $200,000, $100,000. We've supported races that were $30,000 and didn't have any staff. So you can really, your phone calls, your dollars, et cetera, can all go a long way. At Sister District, we're very proud of our outsized impact. Last year in 2020, we raised an average of 10% of our candidates' donations and made an average of 34% of their phone calls. So it's a place where you can really make a difference.
So if somebody was thinking about running for their state legislature, which we need people to do,
yes,
they can reach out to you for help and guidance on how to do this?
Certainly, we encourage anyone running for, we encourage anyone out there who even has an inkling, especially women, especially young people, especially people of color, people who are disabled, differently abled, everybody to run for office. We need more representation in our state houses in particular. I think this is incredibly important because what we're seeing is that although Trump is out of office, Trumpism is not gone.
No.
Trumpism is alive and well, and this is particularly true at the local and state levels.
Oh, it really
and
is.
So,
you know, Lala, I got to tell you, I live in Florida, and, you know, I grew up here, lived in New York, California, came back. Florida is just such a strange place. We have more registered Democrats than Republicans by a pretty healthy margin, but I've been back here since 2004. The Republicans have controlled the state legislature and the state executive, the governor's mansion, and all the cabinet positions pretty much, except now we have a Democrat as ag commissioner. But they've controlled all of that for that entire time. And
yes.
When they control the state houses or the state legislature, they're the ones who get to take the census data every 10 years and redraw the districts. That's where gerrymandering comes in. And that's when they draw the districts to pick their voters. So they are assured that they'll win, even if they shouldn't. Even if, you know, as we saw, for instance, in just look at the House races in the last, in any of the recent elections, more votes were cast for Democrats than Republicans, yet they won a majority of the seats. We need
That's
people
exactly right.
in these state legislatures to start taking it back.
Yes, that's exactly right. And Florida is a really, it's a good and a bad example
yes,
of
yeah.
this. Wisconsin is another example where Dems won every statewide race in 2018 and over 200,000 more total votes for in total for the state assembly when you total them all up. But because of the unfair maps, Republicans won 63 of the 99 seats.
Crazy.
63 of the 99, basically 64% of representation, where they're not even a majority of the voters. And you can see this repeated again in North Carolina, in Michigan, all over. And unfortunately, we're going to see some more gerrymandering this year as well, unless we get some federal legislation passed. And look, you kind of touched on this as well, but there are real implications for people's lives. Of course, it just offends a basic five-year-old sense of fairness, right?
Yes.
This doesn't seem fair. It doesn't take much to realize that this is not the way that our democracy was intended to be. But it has real implications when folks have, when Republicans are sitting in these safe seats, when they know they don't need to follow the will of the voters, they can do whatever they want. And a lot of times it is literally a matter of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a really good example that author Dave Daly brings up.
Sure. He's been on the show many times. He's a friend.
Yes, exactly. So surely he's talked about the Flint water crisis and how that you can draw a direct line from extreme gerrymandering, safe seats to complete impunity and a lack of regard for what the people want, leading to people's lives being impacted, children's lives being impacted. And it's truly a matter of life and death in a lot of cases.
Yeah. You know what, Lala, one of the problems, I think, with getting people to run for these offices, state assembly, like the state house or state senate, the pay is minuscule. It's not a full-time job. So you have to still do something else. So this is a real imposition on people. It's a time eater, an energy eater. It takes up a lot of your focus when you still have to earn a living elsewhere. It makes it harder to fill those positions. And I hate to say it, but on the right, they take care of their people. They take care of their media people. They buy their products. They buy their books. They support their media. They make it worthwhile for them. On the left, we don't really. We do it because we feel like it's our calling or we have to do it. It's our duty. We want the world to be better for our kids. We need to step up, but I wish there was a way to make it easier for people to take on this kind of work.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a lot to unpack there, but I will say that when it comes to this notion of democratic donors and how we spend our money. That's exactly right. We need to feel, we feel like we need to feel good about it, you know? And so that's what we focus on, as opposed to really just giving the money to the places where we can develop the infrastructure, right? There's a lot of unsexy causes that are very, very deserving of our continuous support at every level, you know, grassroots all the way on and up to the very, very major donors in this space. So that's a big part of it. And then you're completely right as well that the issue of state legislature pay is a huge barrier to a representative government. You know, if you look around and you're like, oh, why are there so many, you know, straight white guys who are lawyers and in these positions?
Because they can afford it.
Because, you know, they have the disposable income. Maybe their law firm will let them. And I'm a former lawyer myself, nothing against lawyers, you know, but, you know, but maybe they just have the kind of life situation, the professional situation that enables them to take on this kind of job where they can be gone for 3 months out of the
right
year, or whatever it is that they need to go do this session.
But you know what? I mean, a perfect
example.
Now, a perfect example of the sacrifices they make is Texas.
Yes.
The Texas Democratic House caucus up and left last month to prevent the Republicans from getting a quorum to vote through some of this prohibitive voter suppression legislation that they've been trying to get through. The Democrats, the only way they could stop them, because they didn't have enough votes to stop them, was to say, if we don't show up, they don't have a quorum, they can't conduct business, they can't take a vote. They left the state. They went to D.C., where they lobbied Congress on passing the voting rights, S1 and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But now Congress is on break. Most of them still stayed behind because Governor Abbott called a second special session because the first one expired. So they were like, we still have to prevent this legislation from going through. Well, I guess it was yesterday or today, three of them went back. And guess what? That gave them the quorum. And so they were able to pass this horrible legislation. So Texas is going to be yet the next state that can tell you, that can say they can have a free and fair election. But if the governor doesn't like the outcome of the election, he can claim there were irregularities. And so we need to put our own people in there, and we're going to bring in our own slate of electors, and we're going to redo that. We're going to just call the election in a different way. It sounds like I'm making this up, but that's really what they're doing, isn't it?
It is exactly right. And I just, you know, I have to stop for a moment and say that the Texas legislators, all of them who left to break quorum, incredibly brave, incredibly at the sacrifice and their own, you know, emotional and monetary and peril. You know, Ann Johnson, Representative Ann Johnson, was the only red to blue flip in Texas. Sister District was very proud to support her and to see her become a leading voice in the Texas walkout. And we know that there were others as well. One representative even had to postpone her own wedding, you know, to make this happen. And so it's, you know, people are not taking this lightly. This is a very, very serious situation. And although, you know, this battle has been lost for now. You know, I think that there's so many more to come. And I think it's really, really important to do as you're doing, shine a light on what this really is. This is all premised on the big lie. This is all about, you know, this kind of idea of election fraud that there is no widespread evidence of at all. And there is no sense that there's no evidence to show that there are any actual problems that they are trying to address. Let's be really clear that what they are trying to do is to target those exact methods that were implemented by Harris County, which is where Houston is, which is where the people of color are, that were very successfully implemented during the pandemic to result in record turnout. And so what we're talking about is drive-through voting, is early voting, is having people being able to come accompany you to vote, and so on and so forth. And that's exactly what they're trying to do.
Exactly. And just like in Georgia, where, you know, Stacey Abrams is a force of nature. She's incredible, because I just read something like 95% of Georgians are now registered to vote. That's a direct result of her work. She does deserve to be governor of Georgia. I hope she runs and I hope she wins, because she deserves it. But again, because they saw such huge turnout and people of color turning out in huge numbers, that's what freaked them out. And that's what made, you know, Donald Trump do all these contortions to try to overturn the election. Well, he couldn't do it because we have laws. But the laws that they're passing now would enable him to do it. That's what, if it were happening now, I think he'd be able to do it. Right?
That's the scariest part, is that, you know, our democracy withstood the test of Trump's every move.
Yeah.
But not only could he run again, but the landscape is going to be very, very different with all of these voter suppression laws in place when 2022, 2024 comes around. And also the redistricting will have been done as well. And so we will be on an uphill battle in terms of our turf in a lot of these states. And I just want to note a couple other trends that are a little less talked about, but are still very important when it comes to the kind of concern about is the people's will going to be respected? And one is the criminalization of election administration, right? That there are also these state laws being passed that really try to target what should be these administrative electoral positions, right? We saw and learned, got some civic lessons in the past election about the importance of some of these election boards, some of these state boards that nobody had ever heard of before, usually just kind of help to play very, very critical roles in making elections happen. But now there are looking to be, the Republicans are trying to impose criminal penalties in certain places. And then also, like you said, another trend is trying to review ballots by the legislature, you know, making it so that state legislatures can say, oh, we don't like the result of this election. Let's just take it over. And, you know, if folks want to learn more about it, Protect Democracy, States United Democracy Center have a really, really have done some really good research on this.
Awesome. OK, so on Monday, the House is coming back for one day. They were going to vote. They have to vote on the budget resolution in order for the second, the reconciliation bill to be written. That's got to be done. But they've also officially introduced again the new John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And I hear they're going to vote on that on Monday, too. Do we know where it stands? Do we know what it's looking like?
Unfortunately, it's still looking quite grim, but I, you know, I think never say never. I think we always need to continue to push, because this is one of the most important pieces of legislation that would be transformative and that would make a huge, huge difference, not only in setting national voting rights standards so that we could wipe out a lot of these Republican state bills, for example, and also because of the gerrymandering reform as well. There has been some talk about, okay, well, this voter suppression laws are here, but we can out-organize them. And that's it, you know, to some degree, it is true. We can out-organize, we can overcome the barriers and get people to turn out to vote, even if it's very, very hard. There's, we can do that. We can't out-organize gerrymandering.
No.
And that it just is, it may unfortunately be a reality that we're going to have a decade of maps again that are very, very unfavorable. And what we're going to have to do is just take a long view and continue to build power.
Yeah. And look, as urgent as it was to get out and vote in November of 2020, it's equally, if not even more urgent, to vote in 2022 and 2024. This is an ongoing battle. It's not one and done. This, they've waged war. We need to protect ourselves. We need to protect our democracy, because it is teetering on the edge. We can lose it. Really, we saw, we came so close, and they're not giving up the fight. So we can't either. I hope people visit sisterdistrict.com. It sounds like you guys are doing great work. Lala Wu, it's great to meet you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Nicole. Great to see you.
You too. Bye-bye. Have a great weekend.
You too.
All right. And it is the weekend now. Yay! I long for Fridays, and it's here. So do something good for yourself. I know CNN is carrying this New York Welcome Back concert. First of all, why? Because the virus isn't over yet. The pandemic is still here, and they're going to pack together thousands of people in Central Park? That kind of scares me. I don't know anything about the logistics, but they've got some great bands lined up. So I'll check it out from the comfort of my own living room where I don't have to wear a mask. But if I go out, I will wear a mask. Please take care of yourself. All right. And know that it's not over and just do the right thing. All right. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you Monday. Yay. I'm filling in for Brad Friedman tonight on the broadcast. So I got to run over there, but I will leave you with the news. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'll see you at Brad's place and then I'll see you Monday. Bye.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that an internal State Department memo signed by 23 U.S. Embassy staffers on July 13th warned Secretary of State Anthony Blinken of the potential collapse of Kabul soon after the U.S.'s August 31st troop withdrawal deadline in Afghanistan. The classified cable represents the clearest evidence yet that the administration had been warned by its own officials on the ground that the Taliban's advance was imminent and Afghanistan's military may be unable to stop it. Hundreds of people took to the streets in Kabul and other cities in Afghanistan on Thursday to protest the ouster of the country's democratic government by the Taliban. Many in the crowd waved the green and black flag of Afghanistan, chanting "Our flag, our pride," and "God is great," while Taliban forces dispersed some of the peaceful demonstrations with gunfire. They killed at least two protesters and injured at least six others in Assadabad. Taliban fighters took down the Republic's flag and replaced it with their own as they rapidly conquered territory across the country. Many women who fear losing civil rights under the Taliban participated in a protest in Kabul, where at least two dozen were injured. The United States and NATO are struggling to speed up the evacuation effort at the airport in Kabul on Friday as criticism grows over the handling of the crisis. Armed Taliban checkpoints, paperwork problems, and other issues contributed to the ongoing chaos and delays as thousands of people clogged the airport, desperate to flee, and thousands more unsuccessfully trying to get to the airport. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said 2,000 passengers were flown out of the country over each of the past 2 days. State Department spokesman Ned Price said 6,000 more people were cleared for evacuation on Thursday, accelerating their effort to get Americans and Afghans who worked with U.S. troops out of the country. Here at home, with kids going back to school, the COVID-19 Delta variant is finding lots of very young victims. Children are filling intensive care beds in record numbers. Not helping the situation are, at last count, 9 Republican governors who think they know more than the medical experts. Arizona, Arkansas, Iowa, Oklahoma, Florida, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah have all enacted laws or issued executive orders prohibiting school districts from requiring students to wear masks. In Florida, the state that's been leading the nation in the latest COVID outbreak, a judge on Thursday rejected Governor Ron DeSantis's move to kill a lawsuit filed by a group of parents that challenged the authority of his administration to stop school districts from enforcing the mask mandates. So the case moves forward. Its first hearing is slated for Monday. The parents claim the DeSantis administration is putting the safety of children at risk by blocking local mask policies. And in Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott just tested positive, the Texas Education Agency confirmed that his rule banning mandates will not be enforced until legal challenges against it are settled. But then the Texas Supreme Court stepped in and declined to block a restraining order against the ban, thereby allowing schools to require students to wear masks. Now, although there has been a mask mandate in the House of Representatives, no such rule is or has been in effect in the Senate. So it came as no surprise that 3 U.S. senators all tested positive for COVID-19 on Thursday. Colorado Senator John Hickenlooper, from Maine, Angus King, and Roger Wicker of Mississippi all released statements about testing positive for COVID-19 within hours of each other, all saying they had mild symptoms, although they're fully vaccinated. Their positive tests highlight the vaccination's purpose to prevent serious illness and death. Here we go again. Capitol Hill was locked down for over 5 hours on Thursday as a man in a black pickup truck parked on the sidewalk of the Library of Congress near the Capitol claiming to have a bomb. The man, ID'd as 49-year-old Floyd Ray Roseberry of North Carolina, streamed himself on Facebook Live for nearly 4 hours, spewing lies about the 2020 election being stolen and threatening to blow up 2.5 blocks around the Capitol before Facebook finally cut the feed and shut down his page. The man surrendered to police after hours of negotiations. And although bomb-making materials were found in his truck, there were no explosive devices. But adding insult to injury, Congressman and Senate candidate from Alabama, Mo Brooks, defended him. He tweeted out a statement that read, quote, "Sadly, violence and threats of violence targeting America's political institutions are far too common. Although this terrorist motivation is not yet publicly known, and generally speaking, I understand citizenry anger directed at dictatorial socialism and its threat to liberty, freedom, and the very fabric of American society." Huh? He continued, "The way to stop socialism's march is for patriotic Americans to fight back in the 2022 and 2024 elections. I strongly encourage patriotic Americans to do exactly that, more so than ever before. Bluntly stated, America's future is at risk." Shouldn't siding with a domestic terrorist be illegal, especially for a member of Congress? Asking for a friend. So you recall how the Texas House Democrats left the state last month, denying the Republican majority a quorum, thereby preventing them from passing new voting suppression legislation. They held a united front remaining in D.C., lobbying Congress to pass federal legislation to prevent these efforts to wrest control of elections. Well, on Thursday, after 38 days, three of the Democrats returned to Texas and to the state house floor, allowing the legislature to reach a quorum, effectively ending the Democrats' valiant effort to protect the right to vote. The three, Representatives Garnett Coleman, Anna Hernandez, and Armando Wall, said in a joint statement that they were, quote, "proud of the heroic work of the boycott and vowed to continue the fight on the House floor." Huh? Well, they cited the catastrophic surge in COVID-19 cases and the need to manage the crisis as their reason for coming back. But even with those three Democrats voting no, the bill will most likely pass. Obviously, a federal remedy is needed. And to that end, on Tuesday, Congresswoman Terry Sewell of Alabama introduced H.R. 4, the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act of 2021. It expands federal voting protections to all 50 states, providing oversight of any state or local government that has had repeated election violations. It would also stop more subtle voter suppression rules and would stop courts from changing election rules that disenfranchise voters during an election. The House will take up that bill when it returns from a break on Monday, August 23rd. But the fate of the bill will probably be determined in the Senate, where so far only one Republican, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, has signaled support. The bill will die there unless Senate Democrats agree to carve out an exception that would enable them to pass it without the filibuster. They gotta do something. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is completely listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.